Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. A campaign that lasted well over a year is over. The change could last a lifetime. Commentator Harvey Wasserman looks ahead to the Clinton-Gore administration. Also this time, wood stoves are good for the environment, right? Saves fossil fuels, right? Wrong, says an EPA official. Only if they're operated properly, says wood stove expert and author Stephen Bushway. And don't just watch where you're going. Look up.
Only about one person in ten really would know what the sky looks like. People will see the sky when it's vivid. That's like saying you can only taste your food if it's loaded with Tabasco sauce.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The earth indeed breathed a sigh of relief as the ballots came in on election night, says environmental activist Harvey Wasserman. Wasserman says it's been a long wait. We reached him at his home in Columbus, Ohio, where he spoke to us on just a few hours sleep the morning after.
It's been a long, one might say even interminable 12 years for protection of the planet and our natural support, life support systems. And I think people who watched in, who were up late and saw Governor Clinton's essentially acceptance speech on the podium there in Little Rock were greatly reassured to hear him mention the first two issues he mentioned for his new administration were AIDS and the environment. And we know that George Bush had talked about being the environmental president, but he was, to put it mildly, an immense disappointment on that score. And people who work on the environment have great reason to be enthusiastic, certainly, about the vice president, elect Al Gore, and to really hope, I think with good reason, that there will be major changes towards the environment coming from Governor Clinton.
Harvey, an observation made during the campaign that many made this year was that we really did not have any Boston harbors, you know, no environmental symbols flashing before us in the advertisements. Why do you think this happened?
Well, it was actually, I think what happened was that the Bush forces conceded the issue, and they were very clever in 1988. As you'll remember, George Bush went to Boston Harbor, although actually the commercial was not filmed at Boston Harbor. They used the place, fittingly enough, that they said was Boston Harbor, but wasn't. But they actually attacked Michael Dukakis for being a poor environmentalist. By 1992, the Bush administration really had no leg to stand on, and they all but essentially conceded the issue and really allowed whatever specifically environmental vote there was to go to Clinton without much of a fight. And they didn't really, the only attacking that Bush did on the environment was to talk about the pollution that had come out of the Arkansas chicken industry. And then, of course, at the very end, to label Al Gore Mr. Ozone and the Ozone Man. But it was a losing strategy, clearly, because the Bush administration, where it had a clean slate and was trying to instill some hope in 1988, had really nothing left to fall back on.
Looking ahead now, Harvey, in the last days of the last Congress, the energy bill was finally passed and now has been signed by President Bush. What are you looking to come out of the Clinton administration right from the start?
Well, the biggest immediate legislative battles will occur in the energy field, and the appointments that will be watched most closely, I believe, by the environmental community will be the appointments of the Secretary of Energy and energy-related. Of course, environmental protection and interior will be key also, but the real battleground in the early days of the Clinton administration will be energy, primarily because the nuclear power industry is at a major crossroads right now. And it's run out of steam with its first generation of nuclear plants, and you're seeing a $20 million national advertising campaign to promote a new generation of nuclear plants. And frankly, if the industry doesn't get that in the short term, it's going to be out of business. They're basically out of steam. And in the past, really dating back all the way to 1970, Governor Clinton, now President-elect Clinton, has been very opposed to nuclear power, particularly on economic grounds. And the the energy bill that did pass just prior to this election was a very pro-nuclear energy bill. There were some features in it that had to do with energy conservation and increased energy efficiency. But primarily, they streamlined the licensing process to benefit the nuclear industry. They cut out citizen participation from that and from the siting of a nuclear waste dump in Nevada and handed very large subsidies to the nuclear power industry. The environmental community is going to be working very hard in the early days of the Clinton administration to reverse much of that energy bill, at least as it refers to atomic power. And we have had from Governor, now President-elect Clinton, strong acknowledgement that he has said basically, we have heard him say, we have him on tape saying in New Hampshire that no new nuclear plants would be built on his watch. And we will be working very hard to keep him true to that pledge.
The thoughts and evaluations of environmentalist Harvey Wasserman, speaking to us from his home in Columbus, Ohio. We expect to hear from him from time to time with commentary on the state of the environment as seen from Ohio or wherever he may be next time. This is Bruce Robertson. Though winter begins December 21st, the heating season begins whenever you get cold enough to turn on the heat. For most, this means turning up the thermostat on a furnace burning oil or natural gas. For many, however, this means going to the wood pile to stoke the wood stove.
Wood burning really became a concern of environmentalists in the early 80s after the oil shocks of the late 70s. Saw an increase in stove sales up to 1 to 2 million units a year.
Robert Labens is an air quality specialist with the Environmental Protection Agency, overseeing wood heater performance standards. To those who heat by wood, thinking it is economical and environmentally acceptable, Labens suggests this. In some regions, or air sheds as they are known, of the country, wood stoves are known to be a major source of air pollution.
Particularly in the western United States and the northwest and the Rocky Mountain states saw an increase in air pollution caused by residential wood burning. In fact, it was determined by some airshed studies there that pollution from wood stoves was actually greater than pollution from industrial sources. These are sources that had spent considerable amount of money to control their particulate pollution.
As a result of this condition, Laban says, the EPA followed the state of Oregon, the first in the nation to develop standards, and promulgated a series of standards to which wood stove manufacturers now must adhere.
In the case of the federal regulations, there's a separate standard for catalytic stoves and non-catalytic stoves. Just to give you a rough idea of how these new stoves compare to the old stoves, the standard for a non-catalytic stove is 7.5 grams an hour compared to the conventional pre-certification stoves, which had emissions of about 30 grams an hour. So there's a significant improvement in emissions of the certified stoves compared to the older stoves.
So gone are the days of the smoke drifting lazily from the chimney, indicating a fire on the home hearth. At least that is the plan. However, Laban says, the regulations are long-term, and it will be some time before all the older, more polluting stoves are relegated to the scrap heap. One deterrent, the cleaner-burning stoves are also more expensive than the old pot-bellied Franklin-style stove.
And there's a lot of misnomers about the environmental impact of wood burning.
Stephen Bushway, speaking to us from Plainfield, Massachusetts. Bushway is a chimney sweep and author of a brand new book, The Woodburner's Handbook, a guide to safe, healthy, and efficient wood burning.
Wood is something that absorbs CO2 during its lifetime, and then whether it rots on the floor of the forest or is burned in a stove, it gives off carbon dioxide. But over the long haul, the balance is maintained burning wood. The particulate matter issue is another concern, and it has been taken on by the wood stove manufacturing industry.
Indeed, as we have just learned from the EPA. But whether you are burning wood in a brand new state-of-the-art stove or one 10 years old, Bushway suggests ways you can improve both your comfort and your economy. First, a note about the wood itself.
I think the important thing for people to remember, Bruce, is that wood be seasoned, that the moisture that's in wood when it's first cut is given a chance to be driven, to just evaporate out of the wood. And hardwoods burn longer than softwoods, and they're more dense, so they have a greater heat content. But softwoods are also burnable if they're mixed with hardwoods, and are faster burning and are good for starting fires.
What really is the true and optimum definition of seasoned?
Well, most of the stove manufacturers now are saying that wood should be no greater than 20% water content by weight. That may sound like a lot, but when wood is first cut, it's around 50% water content by weight. So that is the optimum amount of moisture you want to have in wood, and it takes usually 6 months to a year when the wood is after the wood has been cut and split.
It is difficult to estimate, let alone know for sure, the percentage of water content. To be sure, Bushway recommends getting the wood at least a year ahead. That way, regardless of anyone else's claims, you know the wood will be seasoned by the time you need it. Telltale signs are...
Seasoned wood is has radial checks on the ends of the pieces. In other words, checks that radiate out from what would have been the center of the tree. It also is noticeably lighter, and if you strike two pieces together, they'll have a little bit of a resounding thud to them.
The full effects of the new, cleaner stoves will not be gauged until all the older, dirtier models are offline. On the other hand, says Bushway,
much of the dirty burning that we associated with the earlier stoves was actually more on the stove operator's part than on the stove's part. You have to keep a certain amount of air, allow a certain amount of air to get it to the stove so that the wood is burning with a vigorous flame and all the gases are being consumed.
So you're saying a slow-burning stove, it may conserve the fuel, but it actually is burning it less efficiently?
A slow-burning stove is not even burning more, is not conserving the fuel, because what happens is... the hydrocarbons that are being driven off the wood are not combusting, but going up the chimney. The only thing that's achieved is more convenience for the stove user, in that he's going to find coals in the stove.
And not have to refill the firebox quite so frequently.
Right.
How slow you can go with your stove depends on the design of the stove and weather conditions outside. Hot air rises, you remember. The colder the air outside, the faster the hot air will rise up the chimney, drawing a stronger column of air into the stove from the room inside. The colder the weather, therefore, the stronger the draft, and the more you can cut down the air supply going into the stove, thus burning the wood more slowly. Either way, says Bushway, you want to maintain an operating temperature of 650 degrees Fahrenheit on catalytic stoves, for non-catalytic stoves, slightly higher. Use a thermometer for best results. Now the real question. Is it practical to heat an average-sized family home using wood as your fuel? Stephen Bushway.
As a rule, I don't recommend, I don't feel that wood burning is probably best done alone as a home heat source. I think it makes a good complement to some kind of central heat source.
Robert Labens of the EPA.
In the conventional uncertified stoves, the emissions of particulate matter are probably 100 times higher than those emissions from a gas furnace, and maybe 200 times higher than emissions from an oil-burning furnace. Certified stoves, of course, have much lower emissions, but they're still dirtier than those other heating sources.
So are we? How are we gaining by burning wood?
Well, I'm not sure that there is a gain. People, of course, argue that it's a renewable resource. On the other hand, it is a fairly polluting resource.
So we are back to where we started. Except for this from Richard Heady, director of the energy program at the Rocky Mountain Institute.
Wood provides the United States with twice as much energy as nuclear power does today, even though nuclear power is far more heavily subsidized. But back to the issue of environmental emissions and other environmental matters, alternative heating fuels also impact the environment very dramatically. Don't have to look any farther than the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska to realize that burning oil for generating electricity or for burning oil directly in your heating system has environmental implications, not only through the smokestack of your heating system, but also out in the environment, in the drilling fields, in the transportation systems, in the pipeline systems as well.
The point Heady drives home is the cost we pay for our distributor of a delivery of home heating oil, or the fee we pay included in our utility bill to cover the costs of generating electricity, do not include the full cost of bringing you that energy. The cost of exploring for the oil, drilling for it, piping it or trucking it to the refinery, trucking the gas or oil to regional distributors, and then getting it to your home. Neither the financial costs nor the environmental costs, the amount of energy used to get you that energy. So, only when we pay the full cost of oil, coal, natural gas, or nuclear energy shall we compare the real benefits of turning up the thermostat versus stoking the fire. Richard Heady is director of the energy program at the Rocky Mountain Institute, Old Snowmass, Colorado. Robert Labens is with the Office of Air Quality Planning and Standards of the EPA. Stephen Bushway is a chimney sweep and author of The New Woodburner's Handbook, available from Story Communications, Pownall, Vermont. This is Bruce Robertson. Stop for a moment and think about the last time you looked up at the sky. Can you remember what the sky looked like? If you're like most people, you don't look up much. Your eyes are usually fixed on the road, trees, or passers-by. Jack Borden spends most of his time trying to change our point of view. He runs For Spacious Skies, a nonprofit educational program in Lexington, Massachusetts. He says most people are not sky aware.
If you walk over to people on the most interesting sky day, I mean, assuming that there's no rainbow or no vivid sunrise or sunset, and put your hand over their eyes gently, visor style, and say, how would you describe the present appearance of the sky? They won't know. Only about one person in 10 really would know what the sky looks like. People will see the sky when it's vivid. That's like saying you can only taste your food if it's loaded with Tabasco sauce.
A retired television reporter, Borden admits he himself did not discover the sky until 1984.
I was almost 50 years old. I had been in the Appalachian Mountain Club. I traveled around a lot by air, frequent hiker. I don't even want to tell you all the opportunities that I had to really see the sky, but I never really saw the sky until I was turned onto it, almost by accident, when I was 49 years old. And what I became aware of was my previous unawareness of the sky. I saw more of the sky in a millisecond than I had seen in my entire life up to that point. Well, I can't expect that everybody's going to have this kind of sudden type experience, but you can lead people to it. They have to keep looking at it. And as you look at it in a prolonged way, especially through art, if you have kids draw or paint it, they will become sensitized to it and see its many colors, tints, hues, shapes, and all that. And they will begin to understand how interesting it is and how much you want to look at it all the time, because there's always something going on up there.
Borden decided to share his enthusiasm. He figured if people got excited about the sky, it could become the basis for other learning. So he developed his project to teach people about everything from mathematics to music. 15,000 teachers around the nation use his educational booklets in their classrooms. It can also be found in scout troops, graduate classes, and in prisons. Gerald Abelman is a fifth grade teacher in Green Valley School outside of San Francisco, California. She says the sky works as the underlying theme in her classroom.
Every child has a state. We chart the weather. We follow the weather throughout the states. So we're learning about the weather. We're learning about the states. We charted the weather, what the weather was like in November in 1620 when the Pilgrims came over. So you're incorporating social studies. We do science. We make spectroscopes and sundials. We graph on a sundial. We will graph the shadow, and the child will measure the shadows and then graph the shadows. We make books. The child keeps a daily journal on what the sky looks like. They're writing from the very beginning of the school year through the end of the school year, develops creatively.
Many people ask Abelman why she uses the sky as a theme as opposed to other natural wonders. She argues the sky has special significance.
Yes, you can use the ocean, and yes, you can use the forests, but the thing that's so special about the sky is that you don't have to go anywhere. You can go outside and look up, and it's always there, and it's free, and it's ever-present. And so it's like you don't have to go on a field trip to the ocean to see what you have to see. All you have to do is look out a window.
Abelman says many students do extra work on their own. They bring in drawings or poems they write after school, and the program's influence is evident on a deeper level as well. A Harvard University study found students in the program greatly improved their test scores for basic skills. They also became proficient in the visual arts, writing, and literary comprehension. Borden compares these students to what he calls real environmentalists.
A real environmentalist is a person who feels it deeply. They feel that relationship to the world, that relationship to nature, to living things, to rocks, to the whole of creation. That is what this produces. It produces a love of the sky. It produces a deep emotional bonding with the sky. And from that emotional bonding will spread out to virtually everything. First, develop an emotional bond between the child and the subject, and then the kid will ask for factual information.
With results like that, Borden cannot understand why For Spacious Skies is not in every classroom in the country. He admits there are some skeptics. He has to convince teachers and parents about the program before he even reaches the students. The problem, he says, is that his solution is too simple.
It's purely a matter of common sense, and I find that too many people who have trouble with this are people who have what one could consider a vested interest in complexity. They see the world in such a kind of left-brained, technical way that they can't understand the common sense of For Spacious Skies. But we certainly have enough teachers and parents and kids out there who can testify to the value of this.
Borden offers some tips for those skeptics who still do not know what he's talking about.
Start making a point of watching the sunset just to see where the sun goes down every night. A lot of people don't even know how long it takes for the sun to go down from the time it touches the horizon to the time it disappears. They don't even understand that the sun isn't always going down in the same place all the time. Another thing you do is paint or sketch the sky. Another thing you do is you keep a sky journal. You write about what you saw in the sky. Anything that will draw or attract a person's attention to the sky, get them looking at the sky in a more prolonged and conscious way, will do the trick.
Jack Borden, director of For Spacious Skies, a nonprofit educational organization based on sky awareness. He says his message is basically simple. Anyone who walks outside, lies down in the grass, and gazes into the sky will understand. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, drop us a line, address both your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, zip code of 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 149. That's 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 149. Our thanks to Karen Kelly for Spacious Skies. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.